Hello, I'm Sheila Dillon, and welcome to this BBC download of the Food Programme. For information on the BBC's terms and conditions of use, visit www.bbc.co.uk/radio4. And now, enjoy the podcast.
Brace yourself, because we're on a culinary tour of Mexico to meet a cook who's had more than just a taste of real adventure.
I arrived in Mexico in 1957 with $500 and a half promise of matrimony.
Oh my goodness. Well, Diana has been a hero of mine for a long time. She's such an incredible, feisty woman. You know, it's sort of black and white.
I have to laugh at Mexican chefs today who always say, oh, she's English. I cook with my grandmother and I have to say, Sonny boy, you were in school when I was cooking with your grandmothers.
Our central character is English, though she's not a household name in the UK. She is, however, one of the world's most important and influential cooks and food writers of the last half century. How that came to be is the extraordinary story we'll be telling in this programme. Now in her 90s, she's still working, travelling, writing, and inspiring people to think again about food. And that takes attitude.
Recently, she was actually described as the Mick Jagger of Mexican food. And actually, somebody the other day, they said they thought they saw her, but there was this woman in leathers. You know, was that Diana? I said, hey, I think that could have been Diana.
This is a story that's more Jack Kerouac or Indiana Jones than Isabella Beaton. And it's a lifetime's work that's also been captured in cookbooks like no other.
So the introduction is from Craig Claiborne.
Yeah.
There's a phrase that stands out. Yeah. Oh, here it is. If her enthusiasm were not beautiful, it would border on mania. What does that mean?
You know, for someone who loves a bit of girl power, she spent 50 years travelling in difficult terrain.
Up the mountains and the ravines and so on.
Completely going solo.
Going to where almost no other intrepid cook ever went.
And she goes alone with a rolled up sleeping bag in the back of her pickup truck.
To find and to document and record the extraordinary diversity of food in Mexico.
And the fact that she was from Essex really intrigued me.
Her name is Diana Kennedy, and we'll hear more from admirers like Thomasina Myers and Darina Allen in a moment. But this isn't just the story of one woman's work, because the story of Mexico's regional cuisines, gathered by this English cook, who'd spent years driving along dusty, dangerous roads in a pickup truck, is now being seen as one of the most precious resources for Mexico's food future, a country with some of the biggest food-related problems on the planet. So welcome to the world of Diana Kennedy and her adventures in food.
People say you're tough. I came here as a single woman in a macho society. I was the gringa. It's tough, yeah. And writing a book is tough.
Like many of her generation, war changed everything for Diana Kennedy. Born in Loughton in Essex in 1923, her father bankrupt, her mother finding work as a teacher, hers was a family that moved from home to home. But in 1941, the year the bombs rained down, she joined the war effort, signing up to the Land Army. And surprisingly, it helped spark a lifelong curiosity.
I was in Carmarthenshire to begin with, and the local food, the cream, the cheese, the fish right out of the rivers, and that was a part of it, just loving to eat. You know, you'd have to start there, and you want to know where the things come from. Just don't sit and say, well, that's a nice meal.
But it was after the war that the real adventures began.
During the war years, everybody broke out of their mould of what might have been their future. And then to hear people talking about their adventures in Canada and Toronto, I thought, well, you know, why not?
To Canada, Toronto, but also Puerto Rico and Jamaica, and a journey that would feature a life-changing stop in a conflict zone.
On the island of Hispaniola, which it shares with the Dominican Republic, Haiti becomes another Caribbean scene of crisis.
The first person I saw in war-torn Haiti, it was in the middle of one of its revolutions, and there were guns everywhere and troops everywhere, it was Paul Kennedy. He was the foreign correspondent in that area and in Mexico and Central America for the New York Times. And as the Mexicans were said, it was un flechazo, you know, an arrow.
They'd eventually marry and in 1957 settle in Mexico, the base for Paul Kennedy's work as a news correspondent.
My first impression was, of course, had to pay a bribe to get my luggage out of the docks. Then took this train over the mountains to Mexico City, and that really was a revelation. Seeing these vast plains, the volcanoes, it was just incredible. For the first time in my life, I had no idea what I was doing. No idea.
Work did come, but real inspiration arrived along with a maid who came to help in the home, a woman who brought an insight into the authentic flavours of Mexico.
Entering at 2 o'clock in the afternoon or 1:30, whatever it was, smelling that rice cooking. You know, that rice when you fry the rice and then you fry the puree of tomatoes into that rice. And it's this flavour that says comida mexicana, no? I just don't know what happened. Greediness, I suppose.
But this was a greediness combined with curiosity. In her spare time, she learnt the basics of Mexican cooking with her friend and maid, an early guide to a growing obsession with understanding lost recipes and tasting forgotten ingredients. This was a world in which the bedrock of the Mexican table, the cornmeal dough or masa, could shift in flavour and texture from one village to the next. Each cornmeal dough in turn creating variations of the flat round tortilla or steamed and filled tamales.
She came along with some corn and her little grinder. How I got the time off, I have no idea. And then she taught me how to make tomatoes way back then in 57.
Further research would lead to stories of cornmeal pies of Mayan ancestry that had survived in the eastern regions of Yucatan, cooked in banana leaves and served at special feasts with hot chocolate. And there were tales of delicate sauces from Oaxaca in the south, made from pumpkin seeds. And again, with the help of her maid turned teacher, Diana Kennedy would develop a deeper and deeper understanding of the ingredients behind these dishes.
She taught me about the chilies, and I'd still have one of her recipes in my first book.
But this first stage of life in Mexico would come to an abrupt end. In 1966, Paul Kennedy, the man Diana had fallen in love with in Haiti, and her reason for arriving in Mexico, had been diagnosed with cancer.
And then, after a dreadful year of in and out of hospital and in terrible pain, Paul died.
And so a different kind of travel in search of recipes and ingredients would now begin. Based in New York, her husband dead and with no steady income, the food editor of the New York Times, Craig Claiborne, encouraged Diana Kennedy to turn her knowledge of Mexican food into a way of earning a living.
To survive, I was giving cooking classes. And so I would be going down 6 months a year to Mexico, travel around for material for my classes. It was tough.
Earlier writers had documented Mexico's regional cuisines before Diana Kennedy, but something was missing. The records lacked detail.
There was a wonderful person called Josefina Velasquez de Leon, and she had a cooking academy in Mexico City. She would travel to various church groups all over the country. So people would come from various walks of life, women, at that time all women, and to give her recipes. And they were recorded. And she was the first one, I think, to make people proud and knowledgeable about the fact that Mexico had regional cuisines. She was the first. But it wasn't enough. I wanted to know more about the chilies that she mentioned, about the ingredients that she mentioned. And that's what set me off.
scale and diversity explain why there was still so much food undiscovered and unreported in Mexico. There's 1.5 million square miles to cover and extremes of topography, from the arid, rugged north to the lush, diverse regions of the south, with its mountains, its coastline and microclimates. Jeffrey Pilcher is Professor of History at Toronto University and author of Planet Taco, A Global History of Mexican Food.
So these sort of two halves, the better watered, the more ecologically diverse society, and then the more desert society, were, since pre-Hispanic times, major cultural division in Mexico.
A cultural divide that also created a culinary one. Overlaying the forces of climate and topography were echoes of the ancient cultures. The Olmec, Maya, and Aztec, they all left their mark.
The Mayas cooked their corn very differently than did the people in the Central Valley of Mexico and other societies in Oaxaca, the Zapotec and Mixtec Indians, and Michoacán, the state where Diana lives.
And so by traveling through these different regions, the food stories could come to life. They could be tasted.
With microclimates, you get biodiversity. And then with indigenous cultures, you get different ways of dealing with or cooking those plants or eating them. And that's what fascinated me. I still got my notebooks in 65 of Oaxaca and down through Chiapas and to see some of the ceremonies and try the food around there. And again, lots of lights went sparking off in my head.
Another reason why there were still pockets of unreported foods waiting to be discovered was their value had been hidden by centuries of colonization.
Mexican food did not travel for a very long time, and part of the reason for that was that European Spaniards who came during the colonial period wanted to eat European food. They saw their own culture as superior, and they saw the indigenous culture as something that they should transform. They wanted to create, and in the name of Mexico in the colonial period was New Spain, and they wanted to create that New Spain. And part of that was by implanting European cuisine. And so there was just this sense that Mexican food was not very interesting. And so maize to this day in Europe is seen really as something you feed to livestock, not something that people eat.
And the influence of the other cultures that had made Mexico their home could also be detected in the regional cuisines. From African slaves and Asian traders to the French rulers of the 19th century.
France becomes the center of civilization, and French cuisine is seen as being the ideal to which elite Mexicans aspire.
You might be listening to this and wondering why one of the richest and most diverse food cultures on the planet is still so unfamiliar to us. Well, that's partly because by the 19th century, a version of this story had started to be told from over the border by American Mexicans. The Tex-Mex story was the one that would travel.
First of all, it's a northern Mexican food because, of course, places like California and Texas were formerly part of Mexico. And so, for example, it was wheat tortillas instead of corn. And it was much more meat and a lot less of the chilies and vegetables that you find in Mesoamerican southern Mexico. That food then gets transformed by the food processing industry and turned into chili con carne and canned tamales and taco shells.
Which is why the solo mission of an English woman to seek out the truth of Mexico's food culture was so important. A mission that could mean driving hundreds of miles in search of a single rumoured recipe in an unexplored village, to go where no intrepid cook had ever gone before, and to spend time with the women, the home cooks, who held the secrets of Mexico's authentic flavours.
I think they were as curious about me as I was about them.
So you would arrive in a place, and what would you do?
Very often in Mexico City, somebody would say to me, oh, I've got an aunt down there. I said, would you give me her address? And they would be fascinated that I had come to that area to find a dish I'd heard about. And so I was given introductions, and people were very generous. They would ask me into their homes. But I think I was just very lucky to be with people who were very generous and wanted to share. And I was so innocent. And I wish I'd written better notes. What I think has been lost. When I think of my memories.
As well as the cooks, the source of the ingredients had to be found. Places where disappearing varieties of corn, chilies and beans would be.
When you arrived in a town and there was a market, how important was that?
That's the first place I'd go. The market was the key. And so, again, where was my camera? Oh, my God. Going into the local markets, you can't believe, which would be just a street market. And people dressed in these white calzones, I think they called them, the indigenous people, coming in. And it would just be something, little stalls in the street, and bringing in, I remember, their freshly fermented vanilla beans. Just incredible. And I didn't realize at the time how valuable the recording of this might be for future.
Because many of those markets, along with the communities they were serving, would soon be gone. Diana Kennedy could travel at a fast pace, but the pace of change in Mexico in the 1960s was even faster.
Mexico in the 1950s and 1960s was undergoing what a period that's known as the miracle. Nobody calls it the miracle today, but it seemed to be an economic miracle where a country that had been long viewed as very backward was industrializing at a breakneck pace. And it was seen almost the way China was in the last 10 or 20 years as a country that was being transformed overnight. There was a tremendous social change that was happening during this period as people moved to the city. And so to look at the countryside the way Diana did and to look at those recipes was very unusual.
And I would go back with rucksacks full of ingredients and try and recreate that dish as far as I could. Many of them didn't speak Spanish, which of course, don't forget. They're indigenous languages. So you just have to observe and find out which flowers they were using, which edible herbs, which aromatic herbs or wild greens they were using. And it was so exciting. It was just, to me, the discovery of something that nobody had written about. I became more and more intrigued by it all and then realized I have to go back and give some classes and make some money and get this book finished.
That first book, The Cuisines of Mexico, was published in 1972, and it was groundbreaking, each page and recipe taking the reader into a town and into a kitchen full of descriptions of a hidden world of regional stews and tortilla, of street food snacks, and homemade salsa. In a kitchen in London, a cook has the book open on page 239. Tomasina Myers is the founder of the restaurant Oaxaca. She's making a salsa and following Diana Kennedy's instructions. Chilies are being toasted.
So already we've got that incredible smoky smell, which is being... I mean, it's almost as if someone's got a cigar in the kitchen here with us. It's really incredible, that smell.
Tomasina Myers' own travels in Mexico provided inspiration to bring more authentic Mexican recipes into the UK. Another inspiration was Diana Kennedy.
What's so extraordinary about this book is that this, just by cooking one recipe, we're immediately transported into one region and into one place and into one specific person who's cooking one specific recipe. So here we have a recipe, a really delightful one, from my old friend Maria Emilia Farias. It's a wonderfully rich first course and should be followed by something very simple. And without Diana having travelled around the country, this just wouldn't be available to us. So right now I am tearing open my chilies, which are dried, of course. So they are pasillas. It's quite a tough skin. This one's an older one because you can hear that it's a bit more papery, drier, and that lovely tinkle of dried seeds. 200 varieties of chilies. Some are tobaccoy, some are sweet, some are grassy. You're talking about extraordinary flavour that's going on.
Chilies are added to the tomatoes, heated in a dry pan, the skin slightly burnt.
I'm going to give it a little quick blitz. And it's got a very, very gentle background heat. And then the fruitiness of the tomatoes really coming through. I could live on that sauce for quite a long time.
You really could.
I think I'll have that for my supper.
Diana Kennedy's research on Mexican food is captured in her 9 books. But her life's work can also be found in and around the home she lives in, south of Mexico City, in the state of Michoacán, a home she started to build in 1979. And it's to that house that chefs, food writers and students travel from around the world to learn about Mexican food. James Casey, editor of Swallow magazine, paid a recent visit.
The property is based in quite dense forest just outside of Zitácuaro, which is a small town in Michoacán. You drive up quite a steep hill through very small winding streets, past churches and small villages. But once you walk up through that, you're sort of struck by how remote it really is. I mean, you just hear the sound of nature. The plants in the greenhouse, the plants on the property itself, they really are a result of her having collected throughout the years things throughout Mexico.
Now look, we've got, oh my goodness, they're ready, the first tomatoes. Oh, the first tomatoes, the big tomatoes of the year.
All sorts of fruits, vegetables, figs, fennel, Sevilla oranges, lots of citrus, passion fruits, bananas, mangoes.
And this is a sour lime, a bitter lime, that's used in Yucatan for their sopa de lima.
By planting all those things, she's able to independently do her research and her work about writing her cookbooks and cooking the recipes that she does by having them all at hand and not having to go outside. And as you walk up the hill towards the house, the first thing you walk into is a terrace area. And the terrace itself leads you into the kitchen.
Okay. Just shaving a bit of garlic in here because I didn't get it ready in time.
And lining the walls are all sorts of vinegars that she's made. In one case, there is a pineapple vinegar, which tastes remarkably like balsamic vinegar. Okay. Her larder is exceptionally revealing as an insight into Diana's mind, really being sustainably minded. She makes a point to keep everything. There's no waste whatsoever, so anything that isn't eaten is frozen.
And the cheese that's in front of us?
That's a queso fresco made by a dairy in Hidalgo. And the dairy's gone out of business, and it's the best queso fresco I've ever tried anywhere.
I think you mentioned it's been in your freezer for 5 years.
It's been in my freezer for 5 years. And I only drag it out very special occasions. Very, very special.
People come to see and experience Diana to really try and glean as much as they can in obviously what's a limited time from someone whose knowledge is so vast. The generosity that she's had over her career in sort of putting this information out there, and yeah, it's a gift.
But why does any of this matter? What value one woman's research, cooking and writing spanning more than 50 years? Well, an unexpected answer can be found in a protest on the streets of Mexico City earlier this year. Farmers marked the 20th anniversary of the trade agreement that opened Mexico up to food imports from the US, including subsidized corn. Family farms have been in decline, and the world Diana Kennedy documented has become harder to find.
Walmart is now the biggest grocery store in Mexico, and in fact, the biggest private employer in Mexico. And so this flood of foods that's not just reaching the urban middle classes, but that's now even getting into the countryside. And so the traditional foods have been increasingly forgotten. And it's not surprising that rural Mexicans, finally given the opportunity to eat a pork chop or wheat bread, would choose it. And so that's been a significant change.
Another reason can be found in a book about to be published. The Shape We're In, written by The Guardian's health editor, Sarah Bosley, investigates the link between the food we eat and our health. Because Mexico now leads the World League table on obesity, it's given an entire chapter. Recently, its government took the step of taxing sugary soft drinks. And as Sarah Bosley reports in the book, the biggest selling brand by far in Mexico is Coca-Cola.
In the rural areas, Coca-Cola has, if anything, taken the place of water for many families. What has happened is that water is in short supply. There are plenty of homes that still don't have running water, don't have water, drinkable water through the taps. So Coca-Cola is not only seen as this symbol, if you like, of sophistication and culture from the developed rich countries. But I think one of the things that somebody told me that shocked me more than anything else was that you can actually see babies with bottles filled with Coca-Cola in some of the rural areas. That is the sense they have of it being a safe thing to drink.
As even wider changes to Mexico's food culture have gathered pace, so has Diana Kennedy's mission to document and explain what is being lost. She's in her 90s, and yet she still travels throughout Mexico and around the world.
So she's won many awards, including most recently a Lifetime Achievement Award at the James Beard House.
At the Ballymaloe Lit Fest in Cork last month, she was invited by Darina Allen to talk and to explain what Mexican food was and what it can be again. A few days later, she was the guest of honour at the Mexican Embassy in London. The ambassador to the UK is Diego Gomez Pickering.
If you think of any part of Mexico, any province, any state of Mexico, you will have or come up with an example of how Diana's work has helped to preserve the culinary traditions for Mexico's future.
Jeffrey Pilcher goes further. Mexico faces big questions over its food future, not only obesity, but also climate change, water shortages, and food security. He believes Diana Kennedy's record of the ingredients and cuisines that sustained people for thousands of years will come into its own.
Diana Kennedy is different because rather than telling people what to eat, she has listened to how they have eaten. And for these sturdy peasant cuisines, I think they are the best hope for finding a way to adapt in a changing world.
Diana Kennedy has received honours from both the Mexican and British governments. But it's a project that's just getting underway that she believes will keep her work alive for future generations. The National University of Mexico is making digital copies of her notebooks going back to the 1950s.
I had no idea that they thought that work and what I had documented would be of value. And on the database, there will be a section on my work with my name. And it's a great honour and quite a serendipity. I mean, I had no idea at the time. I'm propelled by curiosity, I think. Curiosity and probably stupidity in many ways because I didn't know what I was getting into. So I've just had a guardian angel, really.